Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Native American Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, John Cable, and today I'll be talking with Michael Witkin about his fascinating new book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America, from UNC Press. Against long odds, the Anishinaabe resisted removal, retaining much of their land in the old Northwest, what's now Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Their success rested partly on their roles as sellers of natural resources and buyers of trade goods, which made them key players in the political economy of plunder that drove white settlement and U.S. development in the region. But as Michael Witkin demonstrates, the credit for Native persistence rested with the Anishinaabe themselves. Outnumbering white settlers well into the 19th century, they leveraged their political savvy to advance a dual citizenship that enabled mixed-race tribal members to lay claim to a place in U.S. civil society. Telling the stories of mixed-race traders and missionaries, tribal leaders, and territorial governors, Witkin challenges our assumptions about the inevitability of U.S. expansion. The book is deeply researched and engagingly written, and it contains insights whose bearing on contemporary American society I think will become clear over the course of our conversation. Michael Witkin, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So before we discuss your new book, Seeing Red, can you describe how you became an historian and how your earlier work led you to this point?
Well, I'm a citizen of the Wiclif Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. And I think the thing that kind of drove me into history, my part stemmed from that family history, but also really sort of seeing in the late 80s and early 90s, people in the Great Lakes beginning to engage in a sort of fight for exercising treaty rights, specifically around harvesting reef resources, spearfishing. And it became this hotly contested issue where citizens in northern Wisconsin were alarmed at Native peoples having rights, but it sort of superseded their own or existed outside of rights that they perceived should have been available to everybody. They didn't see that there was a special place for these people in the Great Lakes, for the history that encompassed. And so that kind of glaring misperception between the sort of lived experience of people who grew up alongside Native people in the Great Lakes but couldn't see them as integral not only to the region's history but to U.S. history really made me want to go back and try to sort of recover that and make it more accessible in terms of thinking about Native history and American history as being deeply intertwined. So that kind of experience with this kind of protest and encounter, really contentious protests in the 80s and 90s in Wisconsin, in the Great Lakes, prompted me to go back to grad school, and here I am today.
And what about your earlier book, Infinity of Nations? Can you just briefly talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, that's actually kind of an outgrowth of part of this thing, this idea about recovering this deep history that Anishinaabe people have in the Great Lakes was kind of the quest. I didn't see that reflected in a lot of texts. And so I set about trying to sort of recover that, figure out why that was missing. And in part, it's because it doesn't fit with the sort of standard east to west discovery narrative that you can find in a lot of the sort of early North American history. But there's actually this deep history, and there's great archival resources for somebody who's doing historical work. And so the first book that I wrote explores this sort of history of the Great Lakes, which is really an Anishinaabe history. And it's explored through the lens of the interactions between people from Anishinaabe peoples in the Great Lakes and their interactions with people of the French Empire. The Empire claims most of North America from the eastern seaboard through the St. Lawrence River Valley, through the Great Lakes, out to the Mississippi River as part of New France. But in fact, their empire is really sort of more of a mutually dependent relationship with Native peoples who are engaged with various members of the French Empire in the global market economy that was a fur trade, that was a really important sort of part of the political economy of North America during the early colonial period, during the early ages of empire. And so the book explores that and explores how you really can't understand the French Empire and its sort of emergence and struggles with British colonies without thinking about this larger global fur trade network and their reliance on a large network, political and economic network of Native peoples that made the French Empire possible. And the book explores that, the primacy of Native people and Native politics in this early period, and how this really survives through the collapse of the French Empire onto the beginning of the creation of the American Republic.
So let's move on to Seeing Red. We're now a couple of decades into, I guess, what I see is a still growing trend in American historical scholarship of using settler colonialism as an interpretive framework for understanding U.S. history. And your introduction and first chapter deal in part with how you see settler colonialism unfolding in the Old Northwest. But before we really flesh that out, just a quick state of the field question. Is this still an interpretive framework, or is it more or less the new normal, particularly for histories of American expansion?
It's a little of both. I mean, it's certainly a new normal for people who are thinking about Native studies and Native history. And it's really been, as you said, the last decade and a half, that this has become a really important framework. But having said that, it's still, I think there are still large pockets of scholars who do early America who are not used to thinking about the U.S. post-revolution as a colonial power of any sort. So simply the idea of attaching this framework can still be unsettling for more traditional scholars, maybe people who are focused on kind of colonial development, early revolution, think about the American Revolution as this sort of post-colonial endeavor by the early American Republic. So in that sense, it's been important for people to think about Native history, but there's still a body of scholars that haven't really embraced it entirely.
So throughout the book, you discuss the political economy of plunder. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean there?
Sure. I think that the United States is aspirationally a settler colonial power, and it might help to start with what I mean by that. Traditional colonial power is an outside power that comes in and subordinates an indigenous population in order to extract resources for the metropole, for the mother country. And that colonial power imagines a relationship with the subordinated indigenous population as kind of an ongoing thing, a permanent thing. You can think about the British in India. Settler colonialism is a different form of colonialism. It's a different mode in which the outside power comes in and imagines a relationship with the indigenous population where they imagine the indigenous population being eliminated. They want it to go away or be absorbed. This is what Patrick Wolf, the anthropologist, called the logic of elimination. That is, the settler colonial power wants to replace an indigenous population with a settler colonial population. And if you think about the United States, the Republic is born in partly out of this idea that in coming to North America, settlers were moving into a new world. That new world they imagined as uninhabited or unsettled. Mm-hmm. They knew that there were Native peoples there, but they didn't sort of recognize Native peoples of having established legitimate societies or governments. And so they were able then to extrapolate from that sort of misconstruing of Native society as Native peoples not having taken possession or ownership of the land. Early colonies were founded on this precept. That's what the right of discovery was about. The United States, the Republic, imagines itself sort of expanding into Western territory that's occupied by Native people but hasn't been incorporated into a sovereign entity like the United States. And so I think the America as a settler colonial power aspires to sort of move out into the West and kind of displace, eliminate, absorb native populations and replace them with a settler colony. And what they find, what the Republic does in places like the old Southwest is that it particularly where there's a sort of boom in cotton production, that there's a desire for that land and to transfer that land into the possession of white settlers who want to produce cotton because it's so immensely profitable, that there's a really big push to settle that land, to expel native people, to sort of colonize that land, incorporate it as settler estates into the Republic. And in the Old Northwest Territory, the sort of desire to sort of replace the settler the indigenous population with the settler population isn't quite as successful in places like Ohio or Indiana or Illinois that are territories and then states that are connected by the Ohio River to the Mississippi and then therefore to American markets. In St. Louis, New Orleans, it makes sense to sort of have this commercial economy, to have agricultural settlements that would produce export crops for sale to an American market. But for places farther north, like Michigan and what would now become Wisconsin, it's less possible to settle those places and integrate them into the market economy of the United States in the period of the late 1700s, early 1800s. And so the U.S. ends up getting involved in something that looks more like a traditional colonial enterprise, an extractive industry, largely still focused on the fur trade, where you have a sort of subordinated indigenous population that you are utilizing as a labor force to extract a commodity, in this case, processed pelts, in order to make money. And this is the sort of kind of balance between settler colonialism and colonialism that gets struck in North America, and that in particular unfolds in the Northwest Territory.
So while we'll probably get into this a little bit more later in the conversation, just in broad strokes, how did the political economy of plunder help expose the sort of malleability or instability maybe of U.S. American settler notions of race?
That's kind of tricky. I think that, well, part of what happens when I guess I should explain the political economy of plunder a little more clearly. The United States, when it inhabits, when it moves into the Northwest Territory, as I mentioned, expands pretty rapidly into places like Ohio and Illinois that make sense in terms of incorporating them into the economy of the U.S. Places like Michigan or Wisconsin, where it makes less sense, they are slower to incorporate that territory. They don't therefore press the native population to accept the removal. And what they do want, however, is to sort of extinguish native title in order to bring that territory into the public domain in the United States with the hope that they will eventually settle it. So whereas the U.S. sort of is able to sort of enact, partly through coercion, partly through coercive treaties, partly through warfare, the sort of removal of native people from Ohio and Michigan, they not only can't affect that removal, they find that negotiating treaties to extinguish land title ends up being quite lucrative. And that's the political economy of plunder. So they execute a series of treaties, say Michigan Territory alone, where they will extinguish title to land. They will promise an annuity, that's an annual payment to the native peoples for the extinction of title, for their cession of claims of ownership for that property. And then that annual payment will be split between cash payment and provisions of goods and services. So if they promise $40,000, half of that might be in cash and the other half might be in goods and services. And the annuities usually lasted for periods of 20 years. But what would happen is not only that the title was extinguished and the land was therefore transferred out of native possession and brought into a public domain where the federal government and the state government could make money off it by selling it through the Northwest Ordinance to settlers as homesteads. Under the Northwest Ordinance, kind of 160-acre square units at $1.25 an acre, they would make money off that. But the annuity payment process that was intended to compensate Native peoples usually actually tended to put money into the hands of other settlers, colonial officials, Indian affairs officials, because people in the fur trade, when those payments were made, would claim that they were owed debt left over from the fur trade that hadn't been paid. And so in most cases, an annual cash payment, as much as 90% of the cash would go to fur traders who would claim that it was owed to them by debt. So that cash would not, by and large, make it into the hands of Native peoples, but into merchants and Indian agents and people associated with the fur trade, who would then use that to invest in their own mercantile business, their fur trade business. They also would make money in the provision of goods and services, the other part of the annuity payment. That is, you know, $20,000 in cash, within $20,000 in foodstuffs or provisions like woolen cloth or steel traps or copper kettles. Those were the kinds of things that the merchants involved in the fur trade would sell to the U.S. government to be given out as part of the annual payment for an annuity for a treaty. So you think about that, the people associated with the fur trade and also with territorial settlement, acting as Indian agents or interpreters, or associated with Indians as fur traders, would claim large chunks of the cash payment and then also make more cash in paying off the goods and services portion of the annuity payment. And so this became a way in which the existence of Native people, in a subordinated sense, engaged in a treaty process where they weren't removed, but in place on a reduced homeland, produced a sort of cash economy that made people in territories like Michigan, later Wisconsin, quite wealthy. This, in fact, became the way in which economic development was sort of capitalized in territories like the Michigan Territory. And this political economy of plunder was so lucrative that, unlike places in, say, Alabama or Georgia, where settlers really wanted to expel Native people, in places like Michigan or Wisconsin, the settlers wanted Native peoples to stay because there was a lot of money to be made with their presence in the ongoing relationship with the federal government, the state officials, and Native people.
And again, that's sort of where you're making a distinction between specifically settler colonial and colonial relations. And also, I did want to pull a quote really quickly because you summarize this really well. For those with a copy of the book, it's 148. You write that increasingly tied to the federal government through annuity payments rather than alliance, the political leadership of Native nations in the Northwest saw their influence eroded, and with their annuities plundered, they saw their people become impoverished. Thanks for running through that. Just to move on to chapter two, tell the story of the conversion of indigenous homelands into American settler homesteads. You home in on the story of a settler named John Tanner who ended up moving between indigenous and settler communities and, indigenous and settler identities, I guess, too. At a pretty volatile time, can you talk a little bit about who he was and how his life sheds light on the story that you're telling here?
Sure. This is an amazing story. John Tanner, also known as Shoshawabenese, which is a Ojibwe word for the swallow, it's a name he's given when he's adopted by an Ottawa woman, Anishinaabe or Ottawa peoples, Ojibwe peoples, and Potawatomi peoples. And around the 1790s, John Tanner moves into the region that would now be Kentucky, Ohio, the borderland, say, just south of what would become the Michigan Territory, moves into that region with his father, who's a settler. You could think about this, these are the settlements that are made famous by Daniel Boone. And these are also really volatile settlements because they're on territory his native territory that was ceded to Native peoples at the end of the Seven Years' War with the Royal Proclamation by the British, ceded again to Native peoples after the Treaty of Paris that settled the Revolution, but that was sort of under contention in terms of, as I said before, the U.S. kind of having feeling like they had a claim to it. And so because they didn't feel like the people who in that region would have been Shawnee and Delaware had established a dominion or proper sovereignty over their territory. So settlers would move in feeling like they had a right to settle what they thought in their perspective was unsettled land. This led to a really volatile situation. And John Tanner, named after his father, John Tanner Sr., is kidnapped in this warfare and brought north into the Michigan Territory and adopted into an Anishinaabe family. This is a practice that is relatively common, particularly during the earlier colonial period, but still even in the time period in and around the Revolution, where Native peoples would suffer a loss in their family and they would take a captive adoptee from another Native community, even from a settler community, and incorporate these young captives into their family to replace lost loved ones. And John Tanner is brought into the family of an Odawa woman named Netnokwa, from what would now be Mackinac, to replace her son, who died from an illness. Annette Noqua is a really prominent person. She's unusual in that she's a leader, a political leader, known for her skills as a trader in the Mackinac area. She leaves eventually Mackinac with John Tanner, who she's renamed Shasha Wabenese, the Swallow, as her captive son. She leaves in part because she's afraid that because Americans are beginning to expand into the Northwest Territories, her son might be taken from her. So they migrate to what is the Red River Valley and what would now be the Manitoba region of Canada to engage in the fur trade. And at this time period, around into the 1700s, early 1800s, large numbers of Great Lakes Native peoples would migrate seasonally up to periods for a year or two into that region to hunt. There was an expansion of the fur trade from British traders operating out of Montreal, sometimes out of Hudson's Bay, where they make forays deep into the interior, what now be the Northern Great Plains, in the Red River Valley area to hunt and process mostly beaver furs, but also increasingly buffalo and buffalo hides, other fine furs. And so John Tanner moves out to this region with Noqua, his mother, who's a prominent political leader among the Odawa, who begins to reside out in this region sort of semi-permanently with the people who are coming for long sojourns of a year or two and then moving back to the Great Lakes. And she emerges as a leader in this Anishinaabe community. And he grows up as the son of a really prominent leader. He becomes fluent in Ojibwe, forgets how to speak English, and marries eventually a non-Anishinaabe woman, has children with her. But then around the period of the into the 18-teens, in the 1820s, he has a falling out with his wife. The fur trade begins to collapse in this region. And these two events kind of combine to make him think it's time for him to return home back to his native family. And chapter two kind of follows that journey. But the other, I guess, thing I would do to explain his presence and why he's really significant is that he makes this journey from being a captive adoptee to an Anishinaabe. And it really captures this sort of way in which in this world that sort of predates the American Republic, things like race and identity are defined in different ways in terms of cultural understanding, in terms of how you live your life, as opposed to things we think of now when we think about race, which is phenotype. And a classic story is that John Tanner, as a young man in his teens, early teens, has a horse stolen, and he sets out into the prairies of Saskatchewan to try to recover his horse. He's making his way toward an Assiniboine village. The Assiniboine people are oftentimes allied with Anishinaabe people, but in this case, this person has stolen his horse, and he's trying to find and recover it. He sees a young man out in a field hunting. He's laying down in the grass with a musket and is waiting for geese to pass over. He discharges his musket in order to shoot geese. John Tanner, seeing that he's momentarily vulnerable, rushes him and sort of they wrestle to the ground for control of the gun. And then this contest is motivated by fear, because the other people in this region would be Dakota, enemies of both the Assiniboine and the Ojibwe. And as they're wrestling for the gun, the man on the ground starts to scream that he's an Assiniboine. John Tanner starts to scream that he's an Ojibwe, and they realize that they're sort of nominally in alliance, or the peoples are, and they stop wrestling, and they sort of agree to sort of settle over the goose, and the young man who's an Assiniboine takes him back to his village. And one of the reasons that the encounter is stark and really interesting is that the man doesn't think, well, this is a white guy claiming to be an Ojibwe. Mm-hmm. Instead, he accepts John Tanner as an Ojibwe. He's dressed like an Ojibwe. He speaks Ojibwe language. He sort of knows the protocol of a peace and alliance between the Assiniboine and Ojibwe people. And in that sense, this sort of frontier moment that leads John Tanner Jr. to be captured and adopted is this moment where racial conflict between Native peoples and white people at the edge of the American Republic is very much being defined by race. But then this encounter in the Great Prairies of Saskatchewan shows you that there's still an older indigenous world where encounter and identity is defined by culture and lived expression and kinship and things that are not what we would think of as race these days. And so both these sorts of identities exist in the same time period and are inhabited by the same person. I think it's kind of a remarkable story.
Mm, definitely. So moving on to chapter three, in this chapter, you write that Anishinaabe were, quote, no strangers to ambitious colonial powers, and that as the American Republic expanded, they simultaneously clung to their indigenous identities and struggled for inclusion and survivance within the U.S. So can you talk a little bit about that, and specifically the role of mixed race individuals and maybe especially women?
Yeah, so this is the period when the Americans are expanding into the Northwest Territories. The fur trade is still important in northern territories like Wisconsin, what would now be Wisconsin and northern Michigan. But even in those regions, it's beginning to, people can see an end to it. During this sort of time period, the 1820s and 30s, Michigan goes, I should back up and say, once the Erie Canal is completed in 1826, the northern spaces of the Northwest Territory are much more integrated into the American economy, and so there's more land pressure in a way there hadn't been in the North. So as that land pressure begins to exert itself, Native people in the fur trade, and in particular, the mixed race people who have grown up around the fur trade, become aware of the need to make changes in order to accommodate the expansion of the United States. Two things worth noting. There are lots of mixed race people in the fur trade, in part because the fur trade has usually been about the interconnection between Native communities and fur traders, most of whom would be men who would, from the French era through the British era into the American era, would be young men who were out engaged for long periods of time among Native peoples. There were no women, no white women or no settler women out in these regions. Most of the ways in which these men would find to create permanent connections with the Native communities within which they worked were through intermarriage. And this also had a sort of practical advantage for Native peoples. It would connect them by kinship to the fur traders who were operating in their territories. And because of this sort of necessity for interconnection in the fur trade, you ended up with a large class of people associated with the fur trade and fur trade companies who both had sort of an identity as Native people, usually through their mothers, and an identity with the settler trader community through their fathers. Fathers who were fur traders and who became involved in the trade and had mixed race children would incorporate their children into their fur trade practices. Their bilingualism, their biculturalism were assets in the fur trade. And these were the people in particular who could see that the expansion of the American Republic was going to demand a new sort of skill set. That is, not just the ability to sort of negotiate kinship, seasonal rounds of hunting and harvesting resources, but increasingly being able to deal with American officials and enter into legal contracts or relationships with the federal government over treaty status, things like that. And that necessity would mean that their children needed to learn to read and write in English. And so you have mostly mixed race people involved with the fur trade, but also connected to Native peoples begin to request missionaries. Missionaries in the Northwest Territories had not been as successful as they were in the Southeast. There hadn't been widespread acceptance. Of course, there have been missionaries dating all the way back to the French period who were Catholic. In the American period, a lot of the communities that were really important fur trade communities, Mackinac in Michigan, LaPointe at the southern end of Lake Superior, they had really big established, settled year-round communities with fur trade villages and fur trade outposts and fur traders who had large mixed race families, began to request missionaries who would come establish schools and missions in these areas and started to educate children. And for the most part, the people who were interested in that education were the mixed race children of the fur traders, and the fur traders were interested in getting their children proficient in English reading and writing so they could, again, face the new world coming at them through America. But the missionaries who were sent out were usually young men from the East Coast, Protestant young men who had educations in religion or general sort of college educations. They imagined that they would learn Ojibwe as they try to integrate with their missions into these communities. They found the language really difficult. They found integration into these communities really difficult as single men. And by and large, what they ended up doing was intermarrying among mixed race Native women who were bilingual, many of whom had gone to missionary school that was first established in Mackinac. So they were both Christian converts, but also bilingual and bicultural. And so the American missionary system expanded into Anishinaabe territory, in part by missionaries who themselves, not unlike the fur traders, intermarried with these native women who became really integral in terms of making the missions work. They were the people who could communicate with Anishinaabe people, particularly the non-mixed race trading community, but the indigenous people. They were important for the domestic labor of keeping the mission alive, running the mission schools. In a sense, they were the backbone of the sort of American attempt to create a civilizing mission among native peoples to try to incorporate them into the United States. And the U.S. became utterly dependent on these mixed race native women for the expansion of these sort of mission complex into the Anishinaabe territory.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I also wanted to ask you a little bit, since we're talking about missionaries, about their different take on identity. I found it interesting that, as you state, you write at one point, quote, rather than make distinctions according to race, the missionaries consistently use the concepts of civilized and uncivilized to serve as markers of identity. And then later you point out how the distinction between the two categories could be inconsistent. Can you talk a little bit about how?
Sure. That tracks on to what I was mentioning earlier, that identity for Native peoples, particularly before the coming of the United States, isn't about race or phenotype as we would think about it. It's about kinship. And it's also about kinship and sort of how you live your life. So in other words, if you were a mixed race child, your father was a fur trader and your mother was an Anishinaabe person, and you lived in the village around the mission at Mackinac, Northern Michigan, if you stayed with your mother and your father permanently in that mission territory and learned to speak English, were brought up into the fur trade and lived in that village permanently, you'd be thought of as a mixed race person. And in the context of how the United States had earlier understood the difference between native and non-native, because you were Christian, because you spoke English, that would also qualify you as civilized. So that was the sort of marker that used to be applied to people who are non-native. That's later came to signify whiteness or being white. And in this time period, rather than signifying white, it still signifies sort of a non-indigenous identity. Even the person is very much steeped in their indigenous identity, steeped in the fur trade, but they are living with the fur trade community in a permanent village in Mackinac. If, on the other hand, you're are the child of a mother who had a child with a fur trader, but rather than attach themselves permanently to that trader in the mission at Mackinac, continue to live with your extended native family that would periodically come into the village of Mackinac, but then would disperse at different times of the year, in the hunting season in the winter, harvesting wild rice in the spring, that you lived and traveled with your mother's extended family, you'd be recognized as native, not as a mixed race person. And you would also be construed, at least by the colonial officials, state officials, as being sort of savage or civilized native. All these things are conflated as meaning the same thing. So that when you have the U.S. showing up, a lot of how Native peoples are making distinctions in terms of what the U.S. would think of as race. Are you white? Are you not white? Are you native? Or are you white settler? Instead are being parsed as, are you civilized or not civilized? And this is a sort of crude sort of, like I said, amalgamation of meanings that are attached to, are you civilized, meaning that you're English speaking or French speaking, that you can read and write, that you live in a permanent structure in a village, as opposed to living in the bush with your mother speaking strictly Ojibwe, living your life in a seasonal round with your extended family members. That would be a savage existence. And people were thinking of that as synonymous with indigenous. So this becomes a distinction between settled and unsettled. And the problem in terms of how it's not consistently used, that when American officials come into this region, they are increasingly trying to use markers like white and non-white to distinguish between the settlers and the non-settler society. But they're also still sometimes using these old categories of savage and civilized. And you get a sort of mishmash in terms of the language that shows up, both among missionaries writing about these communities, but also colonial and state officials who write among these communities. And usually with the indigenous communities themselves, they use the term civilized when they want to refer to their mixed race relatives. And they sort of associate with that moniker civilized that they have rights that they as indigenous people don't have, rights to the civil society, participation in the civil society of the Republic, rights to vote, rights to serve on a jury, rights to possibly even serve as a magistrate or in public office. They would consider themselves part of the American Republic of citizens as opposed to non-citizens, which is what the native peoples would think of themselves as being, members of indigenous nations, not part of the American Republic. So it's a sort of continuum between the sort of categories of race on phenotype and also these older categories about race that are linked to notions about the civilization and discovery and things like that.
So you begin chapter 4 with the story of the 1837 murder of Alfred Aitken, and you discuss how this murder and the trial that ensued reveal important insights like the still relative weakness of the U.S. government in the Northwest, and yet again, the instability of race. So if you can, discuss the incident and why it's so helpful in understanding that particular moment in time.
Sure. This built off these things we've been talking about in terms of race versus thinking about somebody as being a savage or civilized. And the story of Alfred Aitken, he's a mixed race child of William Aitken. William Aitken is a Scottish-born trader who immigrates to first Canada and then into the Great Lakes before the Revolution. He is grandfathered into American citizenship status, as a lot of the Canadian and French-born people who are permanent inhabitants of the Great Lakes are post-Revolution, when that territory is transferred into the jurisdiction of the United States. William Aitken is a prominent trader operating out of Sandy Lake, which is this region in the headwaters region of the upper Mississippi, in between Lake Superior and the Mississippi River. He's married to Beshi Bananaquad, the Striped Cloud, who also is named Magda Aitken, but she's baptized, but she doesn't speak English, and she never went to a missionary church, so she only speaks Ojibwe, even though she is nominally mixed race. So she's kind of in this more nebulous category. She's a mixed race person, but unlike most of the mixed race people associated with the fur trade, she doesn't speak English, wasn't educated in the mission system. She's very connected to her indigenous family at Sandy Lake, and that's in fact why William has married with her and is operating out of that village, because it gives him the access to her network of kin and village relationships. His son, Alfred, is his oldest son. He is incorporated into the fur trade, and in 1837 is murdered in his winter quarters by a native man who murders him. And everybody knows who's committed the murder, because the community is almost exclusively native or associated with the fur trade. So everybody knows who did it. They knew what happened. And William Aitken is furious, and he wants the man captured, but the missionary associated with the village at Sandy Lake insists that because this region in 1837 is now part of the American Republic, it's been created as Wisconsin Territory. The Michigan has just entered the Union as a state. Because of this, he convinces Aiken that they need to capture this man and not submit him to native justice, which could involve murder, but it might also involve different other forms of punishment. But a missionary convinces William that he needs to bring the man to justice to stand trial for murder. They capture the person, Chigawakasin, who the big birch who has killed Alfred. They bring him to William Tolliver, who's the governor of what becomes the Wisconsin Territory and Minnesota Territory. He is put into the American legal system. He's put on trial at Prairie du Chien, which would be in and around what we now think of as Green Bay, which is where the westernmost sort of circuit court of the United States Republic is extended to. He's on trial, put on trial for the murder of Alfred Aiken. And the jurors at this point, who are mostly recent immigrants from the West Coast, in a rejection of the idea that I talked about before, which is that we could think about these mixed-race individuals as being civilized and therefore qualifying as white. Recent arrivals from the East Coast see a mixed-race Indian and they think that's an Indian, not a white person, not a settler. And so the jury decides that William, or that Alfred Aiken, rather, the individual who was murdered, was native, even though he was mixed-race, and that the murderer is native. And therefore, neither of them have standing in an American court of law because Native peoples aren't citizens of the United States. And so they release the murderer. And this sets off an uproar among the mixed race community and the fur trade community that are really important in a territory like Wisconsin, because there are very few American officials. There's really no law enforcement. There's no even military power that can be sort of exerted into this area. And so the state and federal officials really rely on the fur traders, who are the most prominent financially, politically powerful people in the region, to help them incorporate the space into the Republic. And part of that bargain is that they're going to count these mixed race families that these men have created as settler families, that is, as white families. And this is considered a violation of that bargain. And so it sets off the whole region in an uproar on what this means. And there's a lot of resistance. And the chapter is really about that struggle as the mixed race community decides that they want to be counted as citizens and as white, and they want their rights respected. And that means, even in this case, they want the murderer to be held accountable. And they want the mixed race child of William Aiken to be counted as a settler, and for his murder to be solved according to the legal system as opposed to native customary law. And it's about that struggle for how you're going to define inclusion and exclusion within the Republic along lines of race when it comes to things that are as tricky as indigeneity. It's racial categories that are not inside the normal black-white racial categories in the Republic. And they're even more tricky because the racial categories among Native peoples themselves are blurry and construed among lines that aren't, you know, race or phenotype, but rather about culture and lineage and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if the governments of the various Northwestern states deemed Native peoples, as you write, unfit for inclusion within the social and political boundaries of the Republic, ultimately, they also made the region inhospitable for black residents. So can you discuss how white settler government in the Northwest came to bear on the free and enslaved black Americans who ended up there?
Sure. So the Alfred Aiken case really sparks, a backlash among the settlers who, in the case of Alfred Aiken, they're not, his murder goes free, but the citizens the mixed race citizens of this case file petitions. They call it a petition, like the mixed race petition of the mixed race citizen Ojibwe citizens, and they demand to be accepted as citizens. And for the most part, they're successful. They manage to win the right to vote in places like Wisconsin and Michigan Territory, which is contested because of the racial disqualification of non-white electors not being allowed. They insist on their right to vote and are given that right. They are essentially pushing back against the Aiken decision, demanding the right to vote and participate in civil society. But as I said, it's a bit uneven. They've won the right to vote when it's been contested in Michigan, Wisconsin, but they lost the case with Alford in the court. And so these things are still being sort of hotly contested. And in the fifth chapter, I explore instances in which there are the right to vote is being contested in this case, in a court case in Ohio, where a mixed race Native person is trying to vote. His ability to vote is being contested. And he ultimately, this person under consideration wins the right to vote. The Ohio Supreme Court decides that he can count as a qualified elector, even though he's of mixed race, that is not entirely white. But the dissenting opinion makes note that the reason they're pushing back and saying no is that if you begin to establish mixed race Native people as qualified electors, we'd be obliged to grant the same privileges to African-American descended people who are free, or mixed race African-American descended people who are free, and that this is something that the settlers of the Northwest Territories would find objectionable. And for those reasons, while they could tolerate mixed race Native people, they don't want to tolerate and be forced to integrate free Black citizens into the ostensible free territories of the Northwest Territory, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, etc. And so the case law goes back and forth like this. There are pushbacks against this, and reflecting that pushback, that allowing Native mixed race people to be citizens would open the floodgates to allowing free Black people to exercise the privileges of citizenship. You have states that begin to enact laws specifically to prevent free Black people from inhabiting or from exercising the privileges associated with citizenship. In all the Northwest Territory states, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, the states establish essentially Black laws that are laws that require free Black citizens immigrating into the state to register with the Justice of the Peace in the county where they reside and post a bond, as well as proof of their freedom, proof that they're not runaway slaves. Similarly, anybody who's going to employ a free Black person is required to check, make sure that that person has posted a bond and proved their citizenship. Otherwise, they will suffer fines. And all these are laws that are meant to require and discourage Black immigration into the Northwest Territories. And there are lots of places where these laws are evaded. And even the state lawmakers recognize that that's happening, that the laws are being evaded. And there are pockets of Black citizens throughout the Northwest Territory. But they continue to try to enact them and tighten them because they want to exclude free Black people from the Northwest Territories. And that exclusion is kind of baked into the cake, because any of these free state territories that have been formed through the Northwest Ordinance as free states through the North, through the Northwest Ordinance, the stipulation is that the free states in the Northwest Territories have to have a fugitive slave clause. That is, they have to guarantee that any escaped slave persons who freed themselves by leaving the slave South into the Northwest can be returned, or have to be returned by law. So these two things are interconnected, the sort of creation of white, free white territories, and the guarantee of white property ownership of enslaved Black people in the South are interconnected.
So in your epilogue, you note that, quote, stealing Native land to generate wealth for white citizens of the U.S. is a feature, not a bug, in the system of governance created by the U.S. and North America. So can you explain what that means, especially in light of the recent events that you discuss in that part of the book, Standing Rock, et cetera?
Yeah. So when I was finishing the first drafts of this that was going out to reviewers, I had stumbled on this connection that was pretty striking to me, the way that I was interested in looking at how the Northwest Territory states were handling questions of citizenship and race as it related to Native people. I had found this murder of Alfred Aiken, and through that murder, I had found these different trials where the right to vote was being contested. And in each of these cases, issues about Blackness came up in the decision-making process. The same was true with the Alfred Aiken case, which we didn't mention because it wasn't relevant to our discussion, but one of the persons testifying on his behalf was a mixed-race person who was Black and Indian, and his testimony was thrown out for that reason. And so all these cases that I'm looking at, I'm finding that while I sort of went in to explore how the Republic was handling the issue of citizenship and mixed race identity for Native people, because there were so many mixed race Native people in this region because of the fur trade, that this was also being very much wrapped up in how the Republic was understanding its relationship to race and free Black people or enslaved Black people. And that these things were completely interconnected. And it was so obvious to me that, that even in places like Ohio or Michigan, which were created as free states, there was a lot of investment in policing Black bodies through these Black laws, in excluding Black people from civil society through these same Black laws, in excluding the opportunity of Black freedom from liberating themselves by moving into free territories through the Fugitive Slave Clause. So that all these things were features of how the Republic was forming, ostensibly a free republic, but one that was formed with a sort of infrastructure designed to limit Black freedom or at minimum police it and tax it. At the same time, you have this republic, which is really being formed and creating the infrastructure that allows us to create places like Michigan and Ohio is entirely happening through the dispossession of Native people. Treaties are used to extinguish title to land that's Native land that they don't want to give up, but that they're forced to give up. That land is then transferred into the public domain of the United States and sold at a subsidized rate to white settlers who can then turn it into their private property, to homesteads. That process of acquiring homesteads is subsidized also in part because the Native people can only sell their land to the federal government. They can't sell it to individuals. They can't hold on to it and then re-release it by leasing it as a timber property, anything like that. They are forced by the federal government to give up this land through treaty sessions that force them to give it up at cut rate costs. And that cut rate savings is then passed on to settlers through the Northwest Ordinance. So that you're sort of subsidizing white expansion, the creation of white private property, and the creation of infrastructure, public infrastructure, because the same land extinction is used to do things like fund public railroads, fund public colleges. The infrastructure of the Republic in terms of the civil society, like railroads, canals, public universities, all funded through land seizures, private property infrastructure of the Republic, the creation of townships that are amalgamations of homesteads that incorporate and enter the union, also subsidized by the dispossession of Native people. So these two things, the sort of policing and taxing of Black bodies, the sort of treaty provisions that are sort of forced on Native people, then treaties are violated time and time again or reconstrued so they benefit the settler community at the expense of the Native community. These things are things that I'm confronted with as I'm writing this history. And at the same time, there's an explosion of violence in Ferguson over Michael Brown, a community where the Black population is being way over-policed, over-taxed, over-regulated, and the result has been this violence. And then at the same time I'm writing, and this is happening, the Standing Rock protest is happening where the pipeline is an oil pipeline is going to go through Standing Rock Reservation, which would potentially endanger that community through oil spills, this big water table that would be exposed to the danger. And the federal government decides that Native people, even though by treaty rights should be able to exclude that pipeline, they're going to use eminent domain and put the pipeline in anyway. And there's a massive protest about that that comes together around Standing Rock. And so these things are still happening in the Republic, and they're a result of this sort of historical legacy that we see through American expansion, through the treaty process, through kind of this legacy of dispossession and regulating policing back Black bodies as part of American expansion in order to facilitate that dispossession.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we begin to wrap up, is there anything you think we missed or didn't talk enough about?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess I would just kind of conclude by saying my first book was really about this sort of power and permanence of indigenous people in the early contact history of North America, how there are huge numbers of Native people that you're probably not aware of through your standard high school education, public high school education, that were there well into the period of the American Republic that you didn't think of that were really important for things that are like the Seven Years' War and the American Revolution and the fur trade. You know, the American people, American Indian people who were really important in charge, they were there in large numbers. They controlled vast swaths of the interior of North America well into the early 1800s. And my first book was about that sort of hidden indigenous history that you know about, the importance of Native people for the first couple hundred years of history after the arrival of Europeans. And this book is about this sort of rapid transition where American expansion actually brings an end to that older social world and really kind of creates the sort of modern infrastructure of America. We don't realize how much that infrastructure is built on converting Native land and wealth into the infrastructure and the wealth of the Republic and the citizens of the Republic.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks. So I want to try something new, at least for me, and have you recommend a new book in Native American studies that you think our listeners should check out.
Sure, absolutely. I can read just one or two.
Oh, as many as you like.
Okay.
Two is fine.
Two off the top of my head that I have just read that are phenomenal. One is a book by Elena Roberts called I've Been Here All the While, Black Freedom on Native Land. And it's about Black Choctaws and Chickasaws, Black Choctaws in particular, and Choctaw freedmen who with the Choctaw people are removed in that Trail of Tears that Americans do know about, the Southeast Indian removal that we briefly mentioned. The Black freedmen and the Black Choctaws who move out west with the Choctaw community. I say Black Choctaws, they're intermarried Choctaws and free African-American peoples who are also constituted a subset of the Choctaw community. And then the Choctaw freedmen who were slaves owned by the Choctaws because they were slave-owning people and that were freed post-revolution and incorporated into their society, keeping in mind that indigenous nations, even after the Civil War, are not American citizens, and they sort of are within American territory, but they are indigenous nations. And this is a story about that community, which is the community out of which springs the Black Wall Street in Tulsa. And so recently the Tulsa race massacre has been in our public consciousness through, you know, popular culture, also through the history becoming more widely known. And this is a story about how, not only this fascinating story about Black Choctaws and Black Indian history, but also about how a Black community emerges in Oklahoma that's really successful because, unlike other parts of the South in the Civil War, these people are compensated. They don't get the mule, but they get their 40 acres as part of the compensation. It's a phenomenal story, really interesting, very little known, really deserves to be heard. And then another quick book, I'll be short, is Paul Barba, a book called The Country of the Cursed and the Driven, Slavery in the Texas Borderlands, which is just a really fascinating book on slave systems that have really shaped what would now be Texas from the sort of pre-colonial period with the indigenous communities, the Caddo, Choctaw, Chickasaw, or the Caddo, the people become the Comanches, the Wichita, the Apaches, and then into the colonial period with the Spanish, and then post-colonial period with Americans who bring the slaving regimes of the Cotton South into the same place. And it's about how all these different slave regimes, from indigenous ones to colonial ones to American ones, have really given shape to sort of modern Texas. And these are both really excellent books in Native history, books that are pretty recent that tell stories that maybe readers aren't super familiar with.
Sounds fascinating. Thanks for the recommendations. And finally, Michael Witkin, always our last question. What's next for you? What's in the works?
I am writing a book called The Battle for North America, which is an indigenous history of the Seven Years' War, the American Revolution, and the War of 1812. I think these are three really big interconnected struggles for the control of indigenous North America between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River. And I think that these big conflicts, which fit into sort of American history, also have a really are to be properly understood, need to be thought through from an indigenous perspective. And I'm working on a book that does that.
Well, that sounds great as well. That sounds fascinating. I want to thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.